Thank you, Mr. Fay. Happy Sabbath to everyone. If you'd like a title for the sermon message, it's as follows: God has no country. God has no country. And it does not refer to a musical genre, just so you're, in case you were wondering. Well, at the high school where I teach, our freshman social studies class addresses important topics in world history. One method that's used to get students to think about controversial issues is to present them with historical or hypothetical dilemmas. And one of those dilemmas is known as Helga's dilemma. It's a hypothetical situation designed to get students to think about what they would do if faced with a moral dilemma in which they had to make a choice between obeying the law or saving a life. And here is the dilemma. Helga and Rachel had grown up together. They were best friends despite the fact that Helga's family was Christian and Rachel's was Jewish. For many years, this religious difference didn't seem to matter much in Germany, but after Hitler seized power, the situation changed. Hitler required Jews to wear armbands with the Star of David on them. He began to encourage his followers to destroy the property of Jewish people and to beat them on the streets. Finally, he began to arrest Jews and deport them. Rumors went around the city that many Jews were being killed. Hiding Jews, for whom the Gestapo, Hitler's secret police, was looking, was a serious crime, and it violated a law of the German government. One night, Helga heard a knock at her door. When she opened it, she found Rachel on the step, huddled in a dark coat. Quickly, Rachel stepped inside. She had been to a meeting, she said, and when she returned home, she had found Gestapo members all around her house. Her parents and brothers had already been taken away. Knowing her fate if the Gestapo caught her, Rachel ran to her friend's house. Now, what should Helga do? If she turned Rachel away, the Gestapo would eventually find her. Helga knew that most of the Jews were likely to be killed, and she didn't want her best friend to share that fate. But hiding the Jews broke the law. Helga would risk her own security and that of her family if she tried to hide Rachel. But she did have a tiny room behind the chimney on the third floor of the house where Rachel might be safe. So the question we then pose to the students is, should Helga hide Rachel? And then explain their reasoning. Now, this is a difficult question for freshmen to tackle. Most say that they would certainly save their friend, even if it meant risking their own lives. However, when the question is slightly changed so that Helga and Rachel are not friends, but simply schoolmates, they don't really know each other, most students flip to the opposite position and say no, they should not, that Helga should not hide Rachel because she should not risk her life or her family's safety to help a stranger. Interesting shift that takes place there with just changing a few words. From the perspective, though, of Christians, the real essence of such dilemma questions is better stated this way. Do Christians have an obligation to obey unjust laws? Do Christians have an obligation to obey unjust laws? I'd like to explore that question with you today, referencing examples from the scriptures and from more recent history. We need to know how God feels about this very important question, because the scriptures reveal that some of God's people will face this very dilemma in the last days. Let's start in Romans 13. Romans 13. There are several scriptures that clearly indicate that Christians are to respect and obey civil laws. Paul makes this point here in Romans 13. We'll start in verse 1. Romans 13 and verse 1. Paul writes, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister for you. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Verse 5. Therefore you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now, Paul seems to be very clear here. He's advising God's people to obey civil authorities, to follow the laws of the land. He says earthly authorities exist because God has allowed them to hold that power. It does not seem like Paul leaves any room, at least in this passage, for disobedience to civil authority. But let's go to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2, again, Paul writing here, and we'll start in verse 9. Titus 2, verse 9. Paul is addressing virtually the same topic here. Verse 9, Paul writes, exhort, or strongly encourage, bond servants to be obedient to their own masters, to be well-pleasing in all things, not answering back, not pilfering, but showing all good fidelity, that they may adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in all things. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. Then on into chapter 3, verse 1. Remind them, they've already known this, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. Now, at first, this seems to convey the same directive that we saw in Romans 13. Bondservants are to obey their masters. We are told to be subject to rulers and authorities and to obey them. But there are some other important statements in the passage that should not be overlooked. Let's look again at Titus 2, verse 10. It says, Christians are to adorn the doctrine of God in all things. They're supposed to pay attention to what God has to say as they are submitting to these authorities. Let's look at verse 12. Christian servants are to deny ungodliness. Now, the Greek word here for deny is rather forceful. It means to contradict, to reject, or to refuse. God's servants are to reject, to refuse ungodliness. Let's look at chapter 3, verse 1. Christian servants are to be ready for every good work. There's a distinction between good works and evil works. and we are to be ready for the good works. The Greek here literally means Christians are to toil in doing good, exerting effort to do good. What if obeying rulers and authorities would require Christians to do the opposite? What if obeying unjust laws would advance ungodliness and thwart good works? Is a Christian still obligated to obey in such cases out of deference for authority? Let's go to Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5. I was a bit worried there for a moment, Mr. Flamin's sermonette. But we're okay. We're going to start in verse 12. And we'll read a good portion of the remainder of Acts 5. Starting in verse 12. The apostles here faced this very question as they attempted to obey Jesus' command to preach the gospel to all nations. What conclusion did they reach to this dilemma? Verse 12. And through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done among the people. And they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. Yet none of the rest dared join them, but the people esteemed them highly. And believers were increasing, added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women, so that they brought the sick out into the streets and laid them on beds and couches, that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might fall on some of them. Also a multitude gathered from the surrounding cities to Jerusalem, bringing sick people and those who were tormented by unclean spirits, and they were all healed. Then the high priest rose up, and all those who were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with indignation. They were angry that this was going on without their consent, approval, support, involvement. And they laid their hands on the apostles and put them in the common prison. But at night an angel of the Lord opened the prison doors and brought them out and said, "Go, stand in the temple and speak to the people all the words of this life." Now that angel was sent by God. And this was a command. Go and speak all the words of this life. And when they heard that, they entered the temple early in the morning and they taught. But the high priest and those with him came and called the council together, and all the elders of the children of Israel, and sent to the prison to have them brought. But when the officers came and did not find them in the prison, they returned and reported, verse 23, saying, "Indeed, we found the prison shut securely, and the guards standing outside before the doors. But when we opened them, we found no one inside." Now when the high priest, the captain of the temple, and the chief priests had heard these things, they wondered what the outcome would be. So one came and told them, saying, "Look, the men who you put in prison are standing in the temple and teaching the people." Then the captain went with the officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people, lest they should be stoned. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council. And the high priest asked them, saying, "Did we not strictly command you not to teach in this name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us." But Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." We ought to obey God rather than men. Here the religious leaders of the nation are clearly commanding the apostles not to preach any more about Jesus. So let's see how the apostles reacted to this prohibition against doing what Jesus had commanded them to do and which the angel had directed them to do. Verse 34, Acts 5:34. Then one in the council stood up, a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law held in respect by all the people, and commanded them to put the apostles outside for a little. And he said to them, "Men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you intend to do regarding these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody. A number of men, about 400, joined him. He was slain, and all who obeyed him were scattered and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census and drew away many people after him. He also perished, and all who obeyed him were dispersed. And now I say to you, keep away from these men and let them alone, for if this plan or this work is of men, it will come to nothing. But if it is of God, you cannot overthrow it, lest even you be found to fight against God." And they agreed with him. And when they had called for the apostles and beaten them, they commanded that they should not speak in the name of Jesus, and let them go. So here they're beaten for what they've been doing, and again commanded, "Do not speak in the name of Jesus." So verse 41. They departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. And daily in the temple and in every house, they did not cease teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ. Isn't that interesting? They deliberately disregarded the civil authorities. Now, does this mean that we can choose to ignore civil authorities whenever we don't agree with their rulings? Of course not. The key is in verse 29, which we read. We ought to obey God rather than men. See, Christians are to obey the law of the land unless that law clearly contradicts the commands of God. Only when this is the case are Christians to reject the commands of civil authorities. This is a vital distinction. Of course, disobedience to unjust or unrighteous laws does have a consequence. The apostles were beaten. Later, most were eventually executed. They were martyrs. Christians have to realize that if they defy unrighteous laws to avoid unrighteous actions, they must be willing to accept civil consequences for those decisions by obeying God first. Those consequences could involve unemployment, or prison, or torture, or even death. There are countries around the world today where even people who claim to be Christian or attempt to convert to what they believe is the way of Christ are suffering all of those things even now. Let's go back to Exodus. Exodus chapter 1. We've already read in Titus how Paul directed bondservants to obey their masters. Yet in the land of Goshen, at least two bondservants secretly ignored their master's orders. We went over this a few weeks ago, but let's do so again. Exodus 1, and we'll start in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply." And it happened in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. This was a tough life. Verse 15. Then the king of Egypt, Pharaoh himself, spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah. Now, it could be there were more midwives than this, and these were the leaders, but two are named specifically. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on their birthstools, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. They defied this law. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children? You know, wasn't I clear? Wasn't the new law clear to you? Kill the boys. Verse 19, and the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. So God must have punished the midwives for disobeying Pharaoh, right? Let's look at verse 20. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew mightily. And so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. These bondservants knew it was wrong to kill those babies against the will of God. And they were willing to risk the wrath of their master, the king of Egypt, to protect the lives of the innocent infants. Let's go to Joshua. Joshua chapter 2. Here we see the account of another woman who feared God to such an extent that she directly disobeyed her king in order to help God's people. Joshua 2, and we'll start in verse 2. Joshua 2 and verse 2. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. So the Israelites were about to move against Jericho. They were sending in the spies to search out the land. So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country. Then the woman took the two men and hid them. She hid them. She did not obey. So she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out. And the men went, where the men went, I don't know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and had hidden them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. The men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven and on the earth. Now here was a woman who was not even an Israelite, who was willing to help strangers of a different nation because she knew it would be against God's will to surrender them to the authorities. Now we know that God would have found a way to protect these men even without Rahab's assistance. And the scriptures do not indicate that God actually approved of the lies that she told to conceal the Israelites. But Rahab acted according to what she thought was right, believing that her actions would please God, and God honored her courage by preserving her life and the lives of her family. Rahab even received a greater honor, becoming an ancestor of King David. Let's go to 1 Kings 18. We've seen the example of some brave women. Let's look at the example of a brave man. 1 Kings 18, and we'll start in verse 1. Another individual who chose to disobey civil authority in order to avoid breaking God's laws. 1 Kings 18, verse 1. This is at the time when Ahab and Jezebel were ruling. And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go, present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth." So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in Samaria. And Ahab had called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. For so it was, while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them, 50 to a cave, and had fed them with bread and water. Now this man knew that the king and Jezebel had ordered the execution of these prophets of God. Here was a man named Obadiah who refused to obey those orders. Instead, he actively helped these men and risked his life to hide them from the king. Why was disobedience to the king an acceptable decision? Let's continue to verse 17. 1 Kings 18, verse 17. Then it happened when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" And he answered, Elijah responds, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and have followed the Baals." Obadiah understood that Ahab's orders were evil and were contradictory to the will of God. He was willing to risk his career and his life in order to help God's servants, and would certainly have faced the king's judgment for his decision had his disobedience been discovered. Most of us are also familiar with the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Let's go to Daniel 3. Daniel chapter 3. Small group of young men who decided that they would put God first in their lives. We'll start in verse 8. These young Jewish men had to stand up for what they knew to be right in the face of an unjust and unrighteous royal command. Daniel 3 and verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. "These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up?" Because that's the law. Notice, unlike Rahab, these young men did not attempt to deceive their king. They spoke the truth, acknowledging that they were not going to obey the king's law. They understood very well their choice could result in their deaths if God did not intervene to save them. Verse 15. "Now if you are ready at the time," he's going to give them one more chance. "If you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a fiery burning furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Verse 16. "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter.'" In other words, we don't need to think about it. We've already decided. "If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king." One way or another, they were getting out of this. "But if not, let it be known to you, O king, we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." And I doubt they were shouting this. I think they were simply stating the truth of their conscience. "We will not worship the gold image." God did intervene to save Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We know that the prophet Daniel faced a similar situation. We won't look at that today, but it's in Daniel 6. Daniel in the lion's den, because he refused to stop praying to God. And there are several more examples of God's servants who chose to go against orders if following those orders would require them to violate God's laws. But there are also true accounts of other men and women in modern history who risked their safety and their lives to stand up against unjust laws. Last summer, I watched a movie called The Scarlet and the Black. It was made in 1983 and starred Gregory Peck as a Catholic Monsignor named Hugh O'Flaherty. I'll spell that for you. O apostrophe F-L-A-H-E-R-T-Y. Hugh O'Flaherty. He worked inside the Vatican, headquarters of the Catholic Church, during World War II. I was so interested in the movie that I ordered a copy of a 2008 book by Brian Fleming. Brian Fleming. There are other books out there as well. This book presented an in-depth history of the life and deeds of Hugh O'Flaherty. And the title of the book is The Vatican Pimpernel. It sounds like an odd title, so I had to read it. O'Flaherty was an Irishman who had grown up in British-occupied Ireland in the early 1900s. He had personally seen many of his neighbors and friends abused by British troops, and some of his closest friends had actually been killed by English soldiers. Ireland had been in a struggle for independence, and the British were trying to suppress that. As he grew into adulthood, Hugh was described as, quote, "humble, gentle in nature, with care and concern for others, with a sense of humor and a willingness to help anyone in need." End quote. He decided to pursue a career as a priest in the Catholic Church, a decision which his family supported. After serving in Haiti and then in Czechoslovakia, he was appointed in 1938 to the Sacred Congregation of the Holy Office of the Vatican. O'Flaherty grew to love Rome and became very familiar with all of its neighborhoods and winding back streets. He also made many friends among the Italian nobility. O'Flaherty was an avid golfer and was often invited to join members of Rome's elite power brokers for golf outings. When Mussolini rose to power, the fascist dictator of Italy, O'Flaherty found himself in the unique position of being the golfing buddy of Mussolini's son-in-law. O'Flaherty received several advancements within the Catholic Church, becoming a Monsignor by the time Italy entered World War II as an ally of Germany. At first, O'Flaherty was rather neutral about the war and saw little difference between German brutality and the violence against his own country that had been perpetrated by British soldiers. But as time passed, he came to see that the fascists of Germany and Italy were much worse. He recalls how he came to the decision to help the victims of fascists after witnessing the violent beating of Jews in the streets of Rome. Benito Mussolini had signed an agreement with the Vatican in 1929, known as the Lateran Treaty. This treaty recognized the Vatican, headquarters of the Catholic Church, as a sovereign country. It was only 108 acres in size and was completely surrounded by the city of Rome. But Mussolini promised to respect the neutrality of the Vatican. By 1942, O'Flaherty was quietly finding ways to assist the victims of Italian and German persecution. He risked his career and his life to find hiding places for hundreds of Italian Jews and anti-fascist Italian dissidents who came to the Vatican seeking help. In July of 1943, with Allied troops advancing into Italy, Mussolini was ousted from power, and the German military itself took direct command of Italy. However, Hitler too ordered that in order not to unnecessarily upset the Italian population, Mussolini's Lateran Treaty would be honored, recognizing the neutrality of the Vatican. German soldiers, however, painted a thick white line around the border, so the Catholic Church made sure, could make sure where their authority ended and the Third Reich began. But this decision allowed O'Flaherty to continue his operations from his office inside the Vatican. By November of 1943, he and people working closely with him had assisted over 1,000 individuals, including whole families with children, in hiding from the Nazi authorities. One Jewish man came to O'Flaherty convinced that he and his wife were about to be arrested by the Gestapo. He begged O'Flaherty to take his 7-year-old son into hiding and handed over a gold watch and chain to pay for some of the costs of caring for the boy. O'Flaherty found a foster family for the boy and then had false identity papers made for the boy's parents, saying they were Italians. They were moved to a safe house and survived the war together, along with their son. After the war, the gold watch and chain were returned to the family as well. O'Flaherty developed a complex network of helpers in carrying out his ministry of mercy, as he called it. In addition to the assistance of a Swiss diplomat, he also acquired an unlikely ally. He was the butler of the British ambassador to the Vatican. He was English, and his name was John May. Yes, an interesting coincidence. But not a relative, as far as I know. O'Flaherty later described May as, quote, indispensable, a genius, the most magnificent scrounger I have ever come across, end quote. Remember, this is the other guy. In his duties at the British Embassy to the Vatican, May had established an intricate network of friendships and associations. He knew where all the black markets were in Rome so they could get food for the people in hiding. He knew all the back alleys and all the boarding houses and developed close friendships with many members of the Pope's bodyguard, known as the Swiss Guards, to protect the Vatican. After the Allied invasion of Italy, many Allied pilots and flyers had to make emergency landings in Italy. Also, many Allied prisoners of war had escaped from Italian labor camps after Mussolini fell from power. Tens of thousands of these Allied military personnel made their way towards safety in Rome, as they had been told to do. Their officers had told them, if you're on your own, try to get to Switzerland or to the Vatican. They will give you refuge. The Germans appointed a man named Herbert Kappler, K-A-P-P-L-E-R, as head of the Gestapo and military police force in Rome. He was ordered to maintain control in Rome and to arrest as many anti-fascist and allied military refugees as possible. Kappler quickly learned about the underground operations conducted by Monsignor O'Flaherty. He ordered Gestapo agents to follow O'Flaherty. This caused O'Flaherty to create a number of disguises that would allow him to slip out of the Vatican to minister to the needs of thousands of people who were in hiding in safe houses all around the city. He went as a coal man and as a postman and various other disguises, and slipped past the German guards. Kappler, frustrated, warned O'Flaherty that if he was found outside the Vatican grounds, he would be arrested immediately. O'Flaherty understood he would then most likely be tortured and killed. On one occasion, Kappler ordered two undercover Gestapo agents to attend a mass inside the Vatican with the mission of kidnapping O'Flaherty, removing him from Vatican grounds, and then shooting him. One of John May's informants told him about the plan, and May arranged a surprise for the Gestapo. Immediately after the mass, four Swiss guards grabbed the Gestapo agents, picked them up, and whisked them across the white line that separated the Vatican from Rome. Waiting on the other side of the line were several burly anti-Nazi Yugoslav partisans who left the agents with various bruises and bumps and sent them back to Kappler as a warning. O'Flaherty, however, scaled back his personal trips outside the white line, but his network of supporters had grown now to hundreds of assistants. Yet he often gave up even his own bed in his Vatican apartment to house escaped POWs, choosing to sleep on the floor so the exhausted men could enjoy clean sheets and a pillow. When the Allies liberated Rome in 1944, O'Flaherty's operation was hiding and caring for around 6,500 refugees, most of whom would certainly have been executed by the Germans had they been discovered. Herbert Kappler had personally carried out the executions of over 330 Italian civilians in a single slaughter in March of 1944. After the war, Monsignor O'Flaherty was asked why he went out of his way to help so many British escapees, given his personal background and experience with English oppression in Ireland. O'Flaherty replied, quote, God has no country. God has no country. He went on to explain that being a disciple of Christ meant looking beyond one's own will and laying down one's life to help all of God's children who were in need of help and support. As the Allied forces were approaching Rome and the German forces were abandoning the city, an unlikely visitor came to the Vatican and asked for an audience with O'Flaherty. It was Herbert Kapler, the Gestapo commander. Kapler told O'Flaherty that he wanted to test whether the Monsignor and his virtues were consistent, whether his oath to help anyone in need was really valid. Kapler asked O'Flaherty to arrange for his own wife and children, who were with him in Rome, to be smuggled to safety in Switzerland. O'Flaherty told him firmly to leave his office and gave him no reply. Kapler was soon arrested by Allied forces and was given a life sentence in an Italian prison, in which he learned that his wife and children had indeed been helped. O'Flaherty had smuggled them safely out of Italy to Switzerland. O'Flaherty even appeared in court as a witness in support of many of his pre-war acquaintances who had supported Mussolini. They did wrong, he told the court, but there is good in every man. The first 3 years of Herbert Kapler's prison term were in solitary confinement. Afterwards, he was put in a regular cell. Kapler was then informed he had a visitor. It was Monsignor O'Flaherty. O'Flaherty devoted one day each month to visiting Kapler in prison. This went on for years. It was, as he said, what the Lord would have prescribed, laying down one's life for a friend. In 1959, Kapler asked O'Flaherty to baptize him into the Roman Catholic faith, and O'Flaherty did so. The next year, O'Flaherty suffered a stroke and was forced to retire to Ireland, where he died in 1963. Now, Hugh O'Flaherty was not a member of the Church of God. He did not keep the Sabbath or the holy days, but he read the words of Jesus, and he tried to follow them to the best of his understanding. And he risked his life hundreds of times to help strangers in need. Let's turn to Revelation 13. Revelation 13, and we'll look at verses 11 to 17. Revelation 13, verse 11. Brethren, World War II, we know, was a long time ago. Some of you remember it, and we're glad you're still with us. But the scriptures reveal that a world crisis far more severe is coming. Some of God's people will be put into the position of having to choose whether to obey the unjust and unrighteous orders of a coming world government, or to disobey that government in order to obey God. Revelation 13, verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. Another image. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the beast, the image of the beast, to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Let's move ahead to Revelation 20. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 4. How is that going to end? Revelation 20, verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things he must be released for a little while. And then notice verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Do Christians have an obligation to obey unjust laws? We certainly do not have an obligation to obey unrighteous ones. When man's laws and God's laws are in opposition, God expects us to remain true to his commands, even if the cost of disobeying unrighteous laws is great. God's authority is above all the laws of all the governments and regimes of this world. Nation states have but temporary authority over people today, and they will all be replaced by the kingdom of God. Truly, in this world, God has no country. He is no respecter of nations or persons, and cares for men and women of all nations who seek to obey his laws and who call upon him for help. God does have people of many different complexions and with many different national passports, chosen by him, who are all called upon to do what is right and to resist evil. And if you look around you right now, you will see some of them here this afternoon.